Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Krause. You may have heard on the news about pharmaceuticals that have been found in lakes and streams recently that are contaminating the water that our water treatment plants aren't even designed to detect, much less clean out. These aren't necessarily pollutants that are dumped by some careless industrial plant or whatever. Sometimes it's stuff like medication that we process through our bodies and then it ends up in the waste stream. But we're starting to recognize that it is actually potentially a problem. Well, on today's episode of the podcast, we are talking to one of our very own Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology faculty members, Dr. Rebecca Clapper of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And in this interview, we talk with her about this issue of different types of emerging contaminants and what can be done about them. So here's my interview with Dr. Clapper. Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. Really happy today we're getting to interview Rebecca Clapper from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, hi. My name is Rebecca Clapper. I'm a professor here at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and I study emerging contaminants, including pharmaceuticals and personal care products and nanomaterials, and what kind of impact they might have on organisms in the environment, and then what could we do to decrease the types of effects that they have on organisms in the environment.
Yeah, great. So what exactly does that mean when you say emerging contaminant? So most people probably know a contaminant, you know, we know that word to contaminate is something that you don't want there. But what do you mean when you say emerging contaminants?
So emerging contaminants kind of fall into two classes of chemicals. They're chemicals that are new to the marketplace, and so we just don't have a lot of information about what kind of environmental impacts they might have. And those are things like new drugs, or the nanomaterials kind of fall into that category. We are just kind of getting a handle on what kind of impacts they might have. And then there's the other kind of category are things that have been around for a while. So a lot of the pharmaceuticals have been around for decades. And just in the last 15 years, we've really gotten a good grasp on how to measure them out in the environment. And actually, those methodologies are improving all the time. And about, I don't know, 15 years ago were the first papers where folks actually detected these things all over the place in the environment. At really low levels. So we're talking nanograms per liter, which is really, really tiny. If you think about how much of a pill you take for a drug, it's usually in the thousands of milligrams. So orders of magnitude different. And so this was a new thing to be able to measure these things. And so then, of course, then you start seeing them all over the place.
Right. So how did you first get interested in this?
When I was a grad student, I was finishing up my degree, my PhD degree, and an article came out that was research done by the U.S. Geological Survey and some other folks, and they did this monitoring going through streams across the United States and found all these medications and some personal care products in streams everywhere. And again, this was when this technology first came about, where they were actually able to measure things down at these really low concentrations. And it was really the first time I thought about all the things that we use could potentially end up going out in the environment, and that includes the pills and other medications that we take.
So if these are such tiny amounts, you said, you know, nanograms per liter, when an actual dose of a medicine would be thousands and thousands of times more than that, why is it important that we be able to measure these things?
So it was thought before that, you know, because when this first came out, this research, that because they're at such low concentrations, they really wouldn't have any kind of environmental impact. And the drug companies, when they submit an application to the Food and Drug Administration, actually put in, you know, hey, we estimated how much is going to go out in the environment. It's going to be really tiny. And by and large, that's what we found. It's a very small amount. The problem is that these are bioactive compounds. And even though a human might take thousands of milligrams per day in order to get the dose right to have a particular consequence, it's possible that some of these things can act at a much lower concentration. And it might not necessarily be the intended outcome for a human, but it might be some bad outcome for a fish or some other organism.
And are there examples of where that's actually been found, where these small concentrations seem to be affecting the wildlife?
Yeah, so the biggest concern to date has been what we call endocrine disrupting compounds, things that affect the reproductive pathways in humans and in fish and in other organisms. And they found that some of the, for example, birth control pill medications, or even the natural hormones that women and men excrete naturally, can have impacts on aquatic organisms at very tiny concentrations, so in this nanogram per liter range. And now we're finding that some of the other compounds that we're measuring actually coming out at much higher concentrations, and those can have an effect as well on the reproductive system. Some of those, there was just a ban placed by the Food and Drug Administration on a couple of these compounds, triclosan and triclocarban and some other ones, I think there are about 15 of them, that are being put into antiseptic hand soaps and other antiseptic products. And there's been mounting evidence that these, at the concentrations that are found in the environment, do cause some kind of endocrine disruption. And so the FDA has mandated that all the soap manufacturers take that stuff out of their soaps. It's not been shown to really have any kind of benefit antiseptically, more than just washing your hands with regular soap and water.
And for people who might not be familiar, what can you explain a little bit what an endocrine disruption would be like in an animal?
So our reproductive system is dependent on all these hormone pathways. Estrogen, which people have probably heard about in relationship to birth control pill medication or just the hormones in general from your general biology class, are really important for reproduction. So is testosterone and several other types of hormones. And these all form part of the endocrine system. It also involves your brain. There are all sorts of neurological pathways that go on that affect your endocrine system and the hypothalamus. So there's this, what we call the HPG axis, the brain hypothalamus gonad axis, and there are endocrine pathways associated with all of those that end up influencing whether reproduction is successful, whether a male becomes a male and a female becomes a female, and whether there's any kind of problems with either sex as far as their sexual function. And this can be behavior, it can be the hormones themselves, or the success of the offspring.
Success meaning their ability to survive.
Yeah, their ability to survive and also their ability to reproduce. So what's really fascinating, a little bit frightening about some of these compounds is that the research has shown that the compound might not only affect the first generation that's exposed, but might affect subsequent generations that weren't necessarily exposed in the same way. So if mom is exposed to one of these endocrine disrupting chemicals, it could have consequences for several generations out.
So now that we are able to detect these tiny, tiny amounts of things that maybe have been in our water streams for a long time, what can we do about it? Or what are scientists doing about it at this point?
One of the things that, for example, and I don't want to pin it all on the Food and Drug Administration, it's not all drugs that are causing this, there are all sorts of chemicals, but the Food and Drug Administration has recently put into its requests information about any medications that they're going through approval process on what kind of hormonal effects, what kind of endocrine disrupting effects they might potentially have. So it's asking drug manufacturers to actually give them that information when they go through the evaluation process, if there's any kind of chance that there might be some hormonally active agent in there. As far as other compounds, I just told you about the triclosan, triclocarban that's being banned. It's been already banned in the state of Minnesota, and now the federal government is following suit. And then other compounds, it's a little more tricky. So some of even just the legacy contaminants, things that have been in use for a long time or in really heavy industrial use, have the potential for causing some endocrine disruption. And what's happened for some of those, they cause all sorts of problems and they've been banned, but they're still out there in the environment. So there are huge cleanup efforts by the Environmental Protection Agency, by governments, local governments even, municipalities, to clean up those contaminants from the environment to decrease their impact they might be having on wildlife. There are some things in our home that have the potential for causing endocrine disruption, and that includes some of the plasticizers that are used for creating the plastics that we use in our houses. And the, of course, quite a few plastics, they're just, you know, stationary things that are in our house, but there are things that we use that are responsible for a high amount of exposure to some of these compounds. That includes things like plastic cookware or things that we store our food in that are plastic. And so when people say, well, what's something I can do? Here's one thing you can do is cook in glass, cook in metal, cook in other things that don't contain those chemicals. As soon as you heat up that plastic, it releases all sorts of chemicals. So one of the number one things I stopped doing was microwaving things in plastic wraps or plastic Tupperware containers. I might store something that's non-greasy or doesn't have a lot of contact with food in a plastic container, but I never heat anything in a plastic container.
Yeah, that's a helpful tip. And then the other thing I was going to ask is, I remember hearing that it's recommended now that people stop flushing unused medications down the toilet. Like, I remember not that long ago, that was what you did to get rid of them. So you didn't just have them lying around the house. But is that true? People should not do that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different collection events that have happened that have started just in the last 10 years when they realized this is probably one source is people flushing medications. Hospitals even are required to dump some of their medications that are unused down the toilet for safety reasons. So up until, you know, about 10 years ago, there wasn't a way to take care of those. And so that was really the only option. It was that or, you know, find some way of disposing it in a landfill. And a bunch of the FDA, again, gave approval through to municipalities. I think Milwaukee was one of the first to have these collection events where if you had police present to collect any controlled substances and pharmacists present to tell you which was a controlled substance and which wasn't, you could go through and dispose of these things. So the controlled substances went to the police department for disposal, and the rest of them went into these big 55-gallon drums to be disposed of at a hazardous waste site. And so there's a question as to how much good that does, and I don't think we have a great answer, although I think by and large, you know, that's one way of getting rid of some of the medication, but a lot of people are taking medications and much of the medication ends up passing through your body when you take the medication. And so it ends up out in the waste stream through the sewage treatment plant just because people are taking medications.
Yeah, by definition, you can't not flush that down the toilet. So
yeah, exactly. And so people have talked about, you know, maybe some pre-treatment system that if you're using a particular medication, maybe there's something you could do or cleanup technologies at the sewage treatment plant, but that's very, very costly. I think overall it would be really good to know if there are some other solutions that are available that maybe would decrease the impacts. And I think one of the problems we have is that we just don't know how much of an impact collectively these medications are causing, or any of the emerging contaminants, nanomaterials, other things. And you know, there's not endless money to evaluate this. So what's the best way to determine whether something is going to have an environmental impact? And that's still a big question mark. And whose responsibility is it to figure that out?
Yeah, so you mentioned nanomaterials, so that leads right to my last question, which is, so you are a faculty member as part of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which of course is the organization that runs this podcast. So how does nanotechnology or nanoparticles, how does that relate to these kind of drug chemicals, compounds that you've been talking about?
So nanomaterials, I classify those as an emerging contaminant, you know, because they're new, but they're also being used in a lot of the ways that we think of other emerging contaminants. So they're being put into sunscreens, cosmetics, they're being used as drug delivery devices, they're put into car tires, into computer screens, into other things, and a lot of those products end up leaching chemicals out in the environment, and those are also kind of in that emerging contaminant class. And so the way that we look at nanomaterials is very similar to the way we look at other emerging contaminants, in that there's a small amount going out in the environment, and the question is, you know, in those small quantities, what kind of impact would it have on organisms? And we do some of the similar kind of testing, although it's a little bit different because these are particulates, so little particles that are less than 100 nanometers in size, or at the point that they're at the sewage treatment plant, they might have aggregated, or in a stream, you know, if they ran off from the road from being emitted from car tires, for let's say, they might be, you know, bigger particles that are in aggregates with other stuff like that's in the environment. And so it's a kind of complicated question when you come to nanomaterials and what kind of impact they might have on the environment.
Okay. So what do you, just very briefly, what are some of the things that you're doing in your lab to answer these questions?
So we do traditional toxicology tests where we look at the impacts on survival and reproduction in things like fish and invertebrates. So these are things that don't have a backbone. Insects that are flying around are an example of invertebrates. In a water system, we look at some water-based insects and then also little crustaceans, little daphnia, which you might have seen in a high school biology class, things that you would collect from a pond and see things swimming around. Usually there's some daphnia floating around there, and they're a model organism for the Environmental Protection Agency because they're sensitive, and so it's kind of a first line of defense. If something is really harmful to a daphnia, it's over long term would be harmful to fish and other organisms too. And then we also use some more modern techniques. We've been using genomic technologies. So looking at how the genes that are expressed in an organism might give us an indication of what's going on inside that organism, telling us whether a chemical has an impact on that organism.
So if people want to know more, if our listeners are curious, do you have any suggestions of good kind of nonfiction resources that people could learn more about these issues or kind of the history of understanding emerging contaminants and stuff?
There are, if you go online and look at, if you just type in emerging contaminants, you'll get all sorts of information from several nonprofits and interest groups that are interested in emerging contaminants. And of course, you have to, you know, it's buyer beware. Some of the information can be very inflammatory. As scientists, we try to evaluate things carefully and really kind of take lots of things into consideration as to whether we call something an endocrine disruptor or an emerging contaminant that's of concern. The Environmental Protection Agency has a website that's maintained out of their Las Vegas office that has information, lots of information from Christian Doughton, who's one of the researchers there and has been working on this issue for decades now from various vantage points. And that's a really excellent resource, you know, a relatively unbiased resource that kind of gives you an overview of what's going on. But Environmental Defense Fund and other places have information on this as well.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you. Any last comments before we finish up?
Oh, I'll say, I didn't mention in the beginning, one of the reasons I also got into this is that when I was a grad student, we had a scientist, Theo Colburn, that came and gave a talk at the Institute of Ecology at University of Georgia when I was there. And she's kind of the person that really, in the public eye, gave a name to this potential problem. She wrote a book called Our Stolen Future. Very easy read. And so if people are interested, that would be also a good place to start about, you know, the potential impact some of these chemicals might be having on our generation and future generations.
Great recommendation. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great. And thank you for doing this podcast. I think it's great.
That's it for this episode of the Sustainable Nano Podcast. Thanks very much to Dr. Clapper for doing the interview for this episode. Thanks, as always, to the National Science Foundation, which provides funding to the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which produces this podcast. We have our usual disclaimer that the statements and opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of the National Science Foundation. We hope you'll engage with us on social media. We are at Sustainable Nano, all one word, on Twitter and Facebook. And you can find tons more great stuff about sustainability and nanotechnology on our blog, sustainable-nano.com. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can find all of our episodes at podcast.sustainable-nano.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks with our next episode.